Hello, this is Earl Fontenelle, this is The Schwepp, and today we are speaking with Christopher Banura, a man who knows a thing or two about the apocalypse of the pseudo-Methodius. Christopher, thank you very much for coming on The Schwepp. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for the honor of the invitation. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah. Well, you have a new book coming out on the pseudo-meth coming out very soon, which is a monograph-length study of this book, coming especially from the Syriac version, right? Which is the earliest version.
Yes, coming from the Syriac version, but also tracing the reception of the apocalypse in the subsequent centuries in the Byzantine world and in the Latin West and really throughout.
So we'll get to that. We'll get to this, the way this text spills out from what could have been a very kind of, you know, some of the Syriac, early Syriac Christian material never leaves the Syriac realm, right? But that is not the case with this text. This text goes on to affect the whole history of Christianity. And whenever an esoteric text, a revelatory text revealing the secrets of the future and the divine plan does that, we take a keen interest here at the Schwepp. So can you introduce us or reintroduce us to the Apocalypse of the Pseudo-Methodius? How would you describe this book to someone who has never heard of it at all?
It is an apocalyptic text. It is somewhat different from what I think a lot of people imagine in an apocalyptic text, because it's not just a vision of the end of the world. It's actually a revelation of the entire course of history. So it begins with Adam and Eve. It traces the early generations from the book of Genesis, and it has a fairly long discourse about the rise and fall of empires throughout time, right? Before landing on the Roman Empire, or the Kingdom of the Greeks, as it often calls it. The Romans and Greeks are synonymous in a lot of Syriac literature, and we could get to some of the reasons why and the implications of that. And then it has this vision of the future, right, which is heavily focused on the coming of what it calls the sons of Ishmael, right? The, for lack of a better term, the Islamic conquests and all the suffering that the Christians will experience. And then the final triumph of the Romans, the Greeks, who will drive the Ishmaelites back into the desert, and the triumph of this last emperor figure, whom it calls the King of the Greeks, that he'll go to Jerusalem, he'll go up on Golgotha, right, the place where Christ was crucified. He'll take his crown, he'll place it on the cross. Those will ascend to heaven, and that will sort of usher in the beginning of the end of time, right? That removes the last thing preventing the coming of the eschaton and the arrival of the Antichrist. And then there's a brief overview of the Antichrist and the return of Christ, and that's where it ends.
We have a whole scheme of world history here. It's, I mean, most people would say this is what's often called an ex eventu prophecy. So it's written after the events it's primarily concerned with, which for our purposes is the Arab invasion and conquest of the Near East, right? It's written after that, but it's pretending to be written before that, describing what's going to happen in the future.
It's pretending to be written by Methodius of Patara or Methodius of Olympus, who lived in the late 3rd, early 4th century, put to death in a Roman persecution in 311, probably. So from where he would have stood historically before the coming of the Arab conquest.
Right. Now, why him? Why would you choose him as the of all the church fathers out there who could have written a future history? Why him? What makes him appropriate?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And there's been a lot of debate. There's not a super clear answer, but there's a number of theories. One thing I would put forth is he's a little bit of a blank slate. People don't know a ton about him. So one of our most important sources on Methodius of Patara or Olympus, again, used interchangeably because we don't know where he was actually the bishop of. We have both attested in other places as well. One of our most important sources is Jerome. And Jerome knows all the things he wrote. Jerome knows that Methodius is a major opponent of Origen. sort of what Methodius is famous for. Jerome does not know when Methodius lived and dies. He says he either was put to death in the Decian persecution, so around 250, or in the early 4th century. So already this author, this very important Christian author, Jerome, right, who's not that far historically removed from Methodius, doesn't know a whole lot about his life. So there's a little bit of a Methodius as a blank slate, I think, is a factor here. But there are other things as well. One of the more common things you'll see in scholarship argued is that Methodius was a chillest or into millenarianism, and that was appealing for an apocalyptic text. I'm more skeptical of that, because the Apocalypse of Pseudo-Methodius doesn't really engage in chillism or millenarianism, right? Which is the idea that Christ is going to come back in the final millennium in history and rule over the world for 1,000 years before the final end. You don't get that in Pseudo-Methodius. The last period of history is actually chaotic and violent and pretty bad. So that is less convincing to me. One reason I think that Methodius was chosen as the identity for this Syriac author is this author was probably a monk and very interested in the idea of sexual continence, sexual propriety, right? The Apocalypse of Pseudo-Methodius attributes both the flood, the biblical flood, to the sins of the early generation, the sexual sins of the early generations of man, and then attributes the coming of the Arabs, the sons of Ishmael, to the sexual sins of Christians. And Methodius, the historical Methodius, one of the things he's most famous for writing is the Symposium, this play on Plato Symposium, but in Methodius's version, it's 10 virgins talking about the importance of sexual self-control, right, of lifelong virginity. And so Methodius is remembered as this panegyrist of virginity. I think that's an important factor. The other important factor, which can open the doors to some of the other things we might want to talk about here, is we know Methodius writes a response to the pagan philosopher Porphyry. That Porphyry claimed that the Book of Daniel was essentially a forgery, that the prophecies in the Book of Daniel were written in the time of the Maccabean Revolt and were meant sort of to justify Jewish resistance to Greek rule.
So Porphyry actually was not
incidentally,
wrong.
Incidentally, yes, Porphyry's view is now the scholarly consensus of when the Book of Daniel was written. Like, Porphyry becomes sort of the starting point then in early modern scholarly analysis of the Book of Daniel, right? But obviously this is also a view of Daniel that sits very poorly with Christians.
Let me just contextualize briefly.
In late antiquity.
If I may butt in. Our listeners are familiar with the great Porphyry. Probably everyone remembers he wrote a book, which is now lost, called Against the Christians. And that will be the lost work that Methodius was responding to, presumably.
Yes, that Methodius was responding to. And incidentally, Methodius's work responding to Porphyry is also lost. But we know of it through other authors, right? And that Porphyry's argument is Jesus quotes from the Book of Daniel. If Jesus is really the Messiah or God, how can he be quoting from this source that's actually made up, right? Or it was like a false prophecy, an invented prophecy. So it's very important for Christian authors to counter that, to show that the Book of Daniel is a real prophecy. And so it is attested that Methodius wrote a response to this. And like most apocalyptic texts, Pseudo-Methodius has a very keen interest in the Book of Daniel. I would say the Book of Daniel is probably the most important biblical source for understanding the Apocalypse of Pseudo-Methodius, and that its whole schema of the various empires throughout history is grounded in the idea of a succession of four empires that you find in the Book of Daniel.
John Collins's study of Daniel is a really good resource here if people want to explore further, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe it's not a coincidence that the Book of Daniel is also, I think, the biblical place before the New Testament where we get the most reference to the resurrection. So it's going to really appeal to Christians because Christianity is very much a resurrection, afterlife religion in a way that most of the Old Testament writings aren't, but Daniel is. So that's going to make it appealing.
Absolutely. So there's a lot that can anticipate Christianity, or that Christianity looks to in its self-understanding. But for Pseudo Methodius and many other apocalypses, also what's key is in Daniel, you get a schema of history built around various world empires.
Yeah.
And that's what Pseudo Methodius is playing off of.
So I'd like to turn to the empires, because what Pseudo Methodius does with the empires is fascinating. Before we do that, though, just a brief thing. He's not a Kiliast. The pseudo Methodius is not a Kiliast, but Methodius probably was. Can you explain what a Kiliast is? And also, the reason that's important, I think, is because he does talk about Chiliades, like thousand-year cycles. So the term Kiliast means something very specific beyond just having thousand-year cycles in your chronology.
Yes. So Chiliasm, or millenarianism, is the idea that in the final thousand years of history, Christ will return and rule over the earth, right? And that there'll be this period of resurrection, possibly. There'll be a period of Christian triumph and world peace and prosperity before the final events of the end time. So you see Hilliasm very prominently in early Christian eschatology. So the historical Methodius, Hippolytus of Rome, Lactantius, they all have these ideas. Hilliasm sort of gets a bad reputation and is undermined and eventually pushed out, I would say, of Christian theology in the late antique period. There's still Hilliasts here and there. Scholars will argue how much of a continual strain it is, right? So this scholar Richard Landis argues that Hilliasm is this sort of underground current through Christianity through the medieval period. Hmm. But people like Origen, philosophers like Origen, really attack the idea of Hilliasm. And so it's less popular. The idea of structuring history around periods of 1,000 years does survive, however, right? So one of the key tenets of Hilliasm is that Christ was crucified in or around the year 5,500 of history, that he came halfway through the second to last millennium, and he'll return at the beginning of the final millennium. And part of why Hilliasm might go out the window is as the year 500 approaches, right? You can't, like, Christ hasn't returned, so that becomes a little, you know, that becomes a little bit of a problem. But what has already happened that way is you have a chronology of history built around the idea that Christ's crucifixion happened around the year 5,500, and that becomes key to a lot of the calendrical systems of late antiquity. And therefore, Pseudo Methodius, like a lot of other texts, structures history around the idea of successive millennia, of which the events that we would call late antiquity fall within the 6th to 7th millennia.
So just to be clear, getting back to our book, we're in the end times now, right? So the readers of Pseudo Methodius are going, Methodius saw it all happening. He talks about the Ishmaelites. That's obviously talking about these Arabs who have invaded, who are causing us so much grief now. We, the Syriac people of the Near East.
Yeah, just to say real quickly, yeah, this is extremely important to the apocalyptic genre, why it's so common to have pseudonymous authors, because part of the way that you legitimize your prophecy is you show that this text has prophesied things correctly, mm-hmm, and that the things that haven't happened, therefore, will probably happen,
right?
So you adapt the persona of someone like Methodius, who lived a few centuries before, so that you could have some prophecies that do come true before the things that you're actually predicting. And in this case, that was the Arab conquest.
Yeah. So now looking back, maybe we can just quickly talk about dating at this point. Our date for this text, the original Pseudo Methodius, which is Syriac, is sometime after the initial Arab conquest, and presumably after the first few years, because it doesn't really, it won't have been initially clear that this is a permanent state of affairs, right? Or that, it, you know, the Arabs are here to stay. At first, the Romans probably thought, ah, more raiding parties, you know, Arabs up to their usual thing. But then it became clear, you know, within a few years, like, oh man, no, this is, we're losing a lot of territory. We're not going to get it back. Until Jesus, you know, comes back on the scene or whatever. So,
well, one thing I want to correct there.
Yeah, go on.
That's often an issue in approaching Pseudo-Methodius. Objection I have to some of the approaches to Pseudo-Methodius is that is taking things from the Roman point of view. This is not a Roman text. This is a text by a Syriac Christian living under Arab rule. Probably there's some debate as to where it was written, or I've introduced some debate, I guess. It's usually the author is usually placed in the area of Sinjar, because one of our manuscripts says that this text was revealed to Methodius on Sinjar. Problem with that is that that's only found in one manuscript, and it's a 16th century manuscript.
Right. So what do they know?
Many centuries later, I think it was probably written towards the northeast of there, around Mount Cardu. Either way, not only is it written by a Syriac Christian, but a Syriac Christian who probably lived in territory that before the Arab conquest was part of the Sasanian Persian Empire.
Okay, that I have not come across before, that idea. So interesting. That sheds a very interesting light on the politics, the religious politics of our author, right?
Exactly. And so while this text is often contextualized in a Roman or Byzantine context, I think it's important to see it more within this tradition of Syriac theology and eschatology. Now, very quickly, just to backtrack on the date, we're very fortunate with Pseudo-Methodius. We have a lot of problems, as you know, with esoteric texts, apocalyptic texts, in dating them. We're very lucky in the case of Pseudo-Methodius that we have four manuscripts that we could date to the 8th century. So we know it's already in circulation by the 8th century. Sort of crazy thing is, those manuscripts are not Syriac manuscripts. Those manuscripts are Latin manuscripts. One of them were especially lucky. It has a list of the dates of Easter for various years, from 727 to 740 something. I don't remember the exact date. If they're giving the dates of Easter, presumably you're not going to worry too much about the day Easter fell last year. You care about when Easter is going to fall in this year, in the coming years, right? So we could say this was probably written in 727 or around then. So now we have one manuscript that we could date very firmly. And so that gives us a pretty narrow window between the Arab conquest, and not only the Arab conquest, but when things start getting pretty dicey for Christians in the Syriac-speaking Mesopotamian world, which is not, incidentally, right after the Arab conquest. Things are pretty calm after then. The new Arab rulers don't want to mess with things too much on the ground. It's really after this very violent and destructive civil war, the Second Fitna, where the Syriac Christians suffer, which lasts through the 680s into up to 692, that the situation on the ground gets very bad. So I tend to think that Pseudo-Methodius is written during or shortly after the Second Fitna. So now we have about a 30 or so year window in which we could place this text. I think it's written in the early Umayyad period, early Marwanid Umayyad period, early 690s probably.
Okay. That is a probabilistic, you know, dart thrown at the map of time, but it's better than we can usually do with this sort of text. So we're in the end times, basically. We're in the seventh of seven total thousand-year cycles, right? The seventh Kiliad. So our author is doing this very clever bit of sort of historical brinksmanship, which pays off if you're trying to prophesy the end of times, which is to say it's soon, but it's not like so soon that we're going to be shown to be wrong anytime in my lifetime. So it's a sort of, it's coming now. There's a sense of imminence, but it's not tomorrow, right?
Yes. So there are some comments throughout the text that Arab rule, or the rule of the sons of Ishmaelite, will last for a certain period of weeks of years, so which are these 7-year periods that the author is getting this from the Book of Daniel, right? That Daniel speaks of weeks of years. Scholars have sometimes tried to use that to date the apocalypse. The problem is the number changes a lot through the manuscripts. Sometimes it's 7, sometimes it's 10, sometimes it's 8. But the key thing is, it seems like this author is predicting the end of Arab rule sometime in the near future. We don't know if that means the same year he was writing or a few, you know, just a few years in the future. But the end of Arab rule is coming. And that Arab rule is this apostasy or falling away or tribulation that is associated with the coming of the Antichrist. That 2 Thessalonians mentions a apostasy or falling away, and that is associated with the period of Ishmaelite rule. Now, the Antichrist is not going to be an Ishmaelite. He's not going to be an Arab. The theology of the Antichrist in Pseudo-Methodius is extremely traditional, very similar to what you find going back to some of the earliest Christian literature on the Antichrist. But Arab rule and the suffering that Christians experience under the Arabs is a sign of the impending coming of the Antichrist.
Now let's talk about the Christians and the nations, because one thing that's really interesting about this work is it goes into, well, first of all, you've got the Romans who are mentioned, right? Who are also called the Greeks sometimes.
Yes.
With whatever the Syriac word for Greeks is.
Ionae. Ionae.
The Ionae.
From Ionians.
Okay. And Yunani in Arabic.
Exactly.
For our author, correct me if I'm wrong, but the name Roman and Greek is synonymous with Orthodox Christianity, right? There's no like pagan Greeks. They simply do not figure. So the what we call the Byzantine Empire or East Rome is a Christian polity.
Yes.
But there's these other Christian polities, and our author is going to use their kind of create like founding figures for them and have them all intermarry such that you create a kind of, is the idea that all the Christian nations are basically related and their ruling families are related, so that when the Roman emperor comes, the true like returning avenging Roman emperor comes at the near the end of time, he's actually the sort of rightful king of all of like Ethiopia and all these places? Is that sort of the picture that's being painted?
Yeah. So you have this idea that all these Christian peoples are interrelated. That takes us back to also the idea of the various kingdoms from the Book of Daniel. It's part of the prophecy of the various kingdoms that he's getting from Daniel. So Daniel has this idea of four kingdoms, right? And one of the big questions throughout antiquity amongst Jews and Christians is this fourth kingdom. The fourth of the four kingdoms is pretty explicitly the evilest, the worst of the kingdoms. It's the persecutor of God's people. Who is that, right? It's pretty, if we accept the scholarly consensus that, as we were talking about, goes back to Porphyry, the Book of Daniel was composed or takes its current form in the time of the Maccabean Revolt. So this final kingdom is the Greek Empire of Alexander and his successors,
yeah,
right? That was
persecuting Antiochus.
Antiochus the fourth, right?
Yeah. He's the baddie.
He's the baddie. But the problem is the Maccabees win. I mean, that's not a problem. That's great. The Maccabees win. They have an independent kingdom. But then these Romans come along and they destroy Jerusalem. They destroy the temple. So they outbaddied the Greeks by far. So where do the Romans fit in this? And so very quickly, you have apocalyptic literature being written by Jews and Christians fitting the Romans into this scheme. And the Romans become the fourth kingdom, right? The Romans become the ultimate baddies. Now, what I argue Pseudo-Methodius is doing, and get a bit more into this in a bit, is it's valorizing that fourth kingdom. The fourth kingdom is no longer the baddie. The fourth kingdom is the hero, right? But it needs to sort out who the fourth kingdom is. And part of what it does is it splits the fourth kingdom into four, because we have this language from the Book of Daniel that the fourth kingdom, that the final kingdom, is going to be divided amongst the four winds of heaven, which is a pretty clear reference to the fact that Alexander's empire was splintered among his generals, his successors, right? Cinemathodius
right.
plays with that, gives it a new spin in his new context, that actually it's divided amongst the four Christian peoples, that it's divided amongst the Romans,
right.
the Macedonians, the Greeks, or the Byzantines, and the Ethiopians. And then this becomes especially important because part of its proof text for some of its prophecies is a line from the Psalms that Ethiopia, there's a line in Psalm 68, Ethiopia will extend its hands to God. In Syriac, that could also mean Ethiopia will surrender to God. And so that becomes the biblical proof text for this last emperor figure surrendering his crown, therefore the kingdom of the Christians, to God. And the problem you run into with that, right, he's found this prophecy from the Bible about a surrender happening, a surrender to God happening. It only works in Syriac, incidentally, so this becomes very confusing when Pseudo-Methodius is translated into new languages. But you have this surrender happening, but it says Ethiopia. So how do you deal with that? So part of what Pseudo-Methodius does is says, well, this prophecy applies to the Greeks, who are the Romans, because they're descended from Alexander the Great's mother, who is an Ethiopian. And so creates this genealogy to link this biblical reference, which it reads as a prophecy, to the Roman Empire.
Okay, cool. So our author does this very interesting thing with the founders of nations, Christianity, and creates this sort of Christian people in history, which is going to come to its climax in a very, very interesting second, not climax. Climax is Jesus coming back, of course, but leading up to Jesus coming back, we have this figure of the returning final Roman emperor, who's, well, I say returning.
Not quite returning. He's arriving. Jesus will return.
He's arriving.
The emperor will
from our perspective. Yes. From our perspective, he'd be returning because the Roman Empire in our day has fallen. But of course, in this day, it has not, and it never will. So tell us about this figure.
Yes. So just real fast, he will, from the perspective of some readers, he will be a returning emperor. We could touch on that when we discuss the afterlife.
Yeah, in the Nachleben
text. Yes. So the last emperor is this somewhat mysterious figure who will arise initially to drive back the Arabs, to drive back the sons of Ishmael and liberate the Christians. So this is where the Vaticania ex eventu end, right? We have the descriptions of Christian suffering under the Ishmaelites, which the author is probably referring to his own time. But then there's this idea that this emperor will emerge. He will drive the Arabs back. He will liberate the Christians. And then he'll have to weather the coming of Gog and Magog, these other eschatological people who get some attention in Pseudo-Methodius. And then the last emperor is going to go to Jerusalem, as I said earlier, go up on Golgotha, take his crown, and place it on the cross and surrender the kingdom to God. Now, again, Pseudo-Methodius in modern scholarship tends to be read through a Roman or Byzantine point of view, in part because this text, for a very long time, was assumed to have been written in Greek. The Greek survives in many more manuscripts than the Syriac, and it's attributed to Methodius. Methodius was a Greek author, so before the whole textual history was sorted out, people just assumed it was written in Greek. Once they started questioning that Methodius of Patara or Olympias wrote it, scholars then came up with the theory that the 9th century patriarch Methodius must have written the text. So up until the early 20th century, the consensus was that this text was written in Greek. Subsequently, it's been discovered that it was actually written in Syriac, that the Greek is a translation. So one of the things I try to do in my book is say, well, let's take a step back here and not interpret this all through the lens of what's going on in Constantinople, right? So let's see this last emperor figure, not as a reader in Constantinople would see them, but at what is a Syriac author living in the lands of the former Sasanian Empire in the aftermath of the Second Arab Civil War. Why would they conjure this sort of figure? And if you go back in Syriac eschatology, especially the Syriac eschatology we find written by authors in these imperial borderlands between the Roman Sasanian Empire and the Christians of the Sasanian Empire. You have this idea that the Roman Empire has to survive to the end of time to surrender its kingship to God. You find this idea already in the 4th century in the work of this author, Aphrahat. He wrote a series of homilies called the Demonstrations. In the 5th demonstration, it's called the Demonstration on Wars. He unpacks this theology about the Roman Empire and its conflict with Sasanian Persia that he bases on the Book of Daniel. We know when he wrote this. Okay. He says he gives the year of the Greeks, the Seleucid, the year in the Seleucid calendar. It's the year 337 AD. So we know when he's writing. And he says the Romans and the Sasanians are fighting. Who's going to win? We know it has to be the Romans because they're the fourth kingdom of Daniel. He does what we'll see Pseudo Methodius do, valorizes this fourth kingdom, ignores all the negative associations that the fourth kingdom is a persecutor of God's people and focuses on it as the all-powerful empire that must triumph in before the end of time, right? Before Jesus comes back, the Roman Empire must triumph. And why? Well, because it gets into this complex theology that sort of mirrors what we're just talking about with Pseudo Methodius and its complex genealogy of this fourth kingdom, that the fourth kingdom was Greek, it was Antiochus, it was persecuting God's people, and God was going to deliver up the Jewish people to their eternal kingdom after they withstood the persecution of Antiochus, but the Jews messed it up. The Jews killed the Messiah. So what did God do? He took the kingdom that he was going to give to the Jews, and he gave it to the Romans. And the Romans are now holding on to the kingship of the earth, this sort of Davidic kingship, until Christ comes back. They are God's viceroys, right? Christ is the emperor. Christ isn't in town right now. So he has a viceroy ruling for him, who are the Romans. And so what must happen at the end of time? The Romans must give that kingship back to Christ. Therefore, no one can beat the Romans because they're God's viceroys. And you see this idea reflected in Syriac eschatology through late antiquity. What I find interesting is you don't see this idea very commonly or really at all in distinctly Roman eschatology. You don't see it in Greek or Latin eschatology prior to the translation of Pseudo Methodius. I think something is going on here where you have Syriac Christians in the imperial borderlands, Syriac Christians in the Sasanian Empire, who are looking at the Roman Empire a little bit like how Christians of the High Middle Ages will conjure this idea of the land of Prester John, right? That there's this mystical Christian kingdom that is great. It's going to come to the rescue of other Christians in their time of needs, right? So they're idealizing the Roman Empire from afar. And part of that is it is God's viceroy. It's holding on to God's kingship. So what I think the last emperor in Pseudo Methodius is doing, Pseudo Methodius is transforming this exegetical reading of Book of Daniel and Syriac eschatology into an apocalyptic narrative. So you need a figure to act all this out. So you have this last emperor who ensures the invincibility of the Roman Empire by defeating all the Romans' enemies. And then he acts out that final act that you need the Roman Empire to do. He literally surrenders his crown to God. He goes to Jerusalem, he puts his crown on the cross descends to heaven so that Christ can return with the cross, the symbol that we know from the Gospels that will be there with Christ's return, right? And with the crown of empire to rule for all time.
There are really weird, as an aside, there are very weird parallels and echoes of that attitude toward the Roman Empire from a Syriac perspective and modern Christian fundamentalists in America's view of the state of Israel, right? They have to be there. They're not us. They're different from us. But they're not even necessarily good, but they have to be there for God's plan to happen so that then we can like get rid of them and move on to the promised, balancing of the scales and everyone gets what they deserve. End of time.
Yeah, I think that's a great analogy that you don't have to assume that this text is Roman. You could see it as a sort of outsider perspective on the Romans, just like you see in modern evangelical, some fundamental evangelical Christianity, the way they construct Israel as people who don't live in Israel, but can have this outsider perspective.
Or maybe go there once on an apocalypse tour to look at the where Armageddon is going to happen, and then get back on the plane and fly home. Well, thank you very much, first of all, for that clear antecedent of this approach to history earlier on.
And you find, just real fast, you find that in other Syriac texts. So there's the Syriac Alexander legend, where you have a Syriac account of the life of Alexander, which incidentally probably influences the concept of Alexander and Pseudo-Methodius. In the Syriac Alexander legend that dates to the 6th or 7th century, usually dated to the 7th century, there's this new book by Tommaso Tissei where he argues that it's Justinianic, so a little bit earlier. That has the exact same idea, that there's the scene at the end of the text where Alexander and the Persian king are sort of having a peace summit. The Persian king calls in some astrologers, and they have a vision of the future. And that, again, you have the conflation of the Greeks and the Romans, that this final kingdom that Alexander has founded, so it's both Greek and Roman, but it's called Roman here, that it's going to conquer all its enemies. And then at the end of time, it will surrender the kingship of the earth to God, and that will bring about the second coming. So you have this idea repeated in late antique Syriac literature. Again, probably Syriac literature outside the Roman Empire, but we don't know where the Syriac Alexander legend is from. It survives in East Syrian manuscripts, mostly coming from around, they're pretty late, but they go back to a prototype from around Lake Urmia in Iran, so probably quite far to the east, right? Where you have this construction of what the Roman Empire is. So even if the Syriac Alexander legend doesn't originate there, right, that it's being copied in these pretty far eastern areas of Christianity that have this interest in the world historical role of Rome and its monarchy.
Yeah. This just makes sense intuitively as well. Now, I don't wish to oversimplify the problems that Roman Syriac-speaking Christians in the Near East had with Constantinople. I don't mean to oversimplify it or make it into a kind of binary, you're either a Monophysite or a Chalcedonian, and there's like the Monophysites are being oppressed by Constantinople. But the Monophysites were being oppressed by Constantinople in the Roman world. So for a Roman Syriac speaker Christian of this period to be writing in very sort of glowing terms of Constantinople as a place from which good things for Christians are going to come, where a liberator is going to come, is harder to just reconcile on the face of it. You think, okay, we don't really know the situation on the ground. It was all very complex. There were multiple church hierarchies at the same time in this area, you know, but still, it's just a bit of a head scratcher. But if this person is just not from Rome at all,
exactly,
it's way easier to understand. Yeah, exactly. A priori.
Exactly. And I should say that Pseudo-Methodius does spread amongst Miaphysite Christians, right? We know Miaphysite Christians referring to it. We do not know the Christological or ecclesiastical allegiance of the author of Pseudo-Methodius, but the earliest Syriac texts to engage with Pseudo-Methodius are almost all East Syrian. That is, texts coming out of the Church of the East. And again, a lot of them from areas from Mesopotamia and maybe the eastern part of Mesopotamia, areas that were either not in the historical territories of the East Roman Empire, or just sort of very much on the borders of it, right?
With the border swiping back and forth depending on recent warfare and stuff like that.
Yeah, so I think there's something going on where you have these populations of borderland Christians and formerly Sasanian Christians who, in this sort of confusing period after the Arab conquests, are trying to get their bearings, right? The Sasanian Empire is gone, right? There's a period where the Catholicos of Ctesiphon, the patriarch of the church, the office is vacant because the caliphs are angry and won't let them fill the position. It's chaotic and it's messy. And I think that at least some of them might be looking to the Roman Empire as some sort of source of hope or leadership, right? This will kind of go away in the Syriac world, right? Eventually things calm down. There's more Renaissance. There's the Catholicos, the Patriarch of the Church of the East, and the Patriarch of the Syriac Orthodox settle down in Baghdad under the Abbasids and have pretty good relations with the Caliph most of the time. But late 7th century, early 8th century, things are messy, things are not sorted out, things are chaotic. And I think we're getting a little bit of a view of that in this eschatological literature.
On that eschatological note, let's finish, if we can, by talking about the Nachleben of this
absolutely
extraordinary work. Now, what's interesting to me is two things. First of all, the fact that it gets translated into every language, and shockingly early, like Latin is kind of coming out of the blue, you know, but it's going to go into Armenian, it's going to go into Arabic, Greek, obviously.
Coptic, Old Church Slavonic. Probably.
Coptic. Yeah, that's interesting. The other thing I find very interesting is the fact that probably no one in our audience has heard of this text before. The number of people who have even heard of this text will be very small. I include myself in that. I'd come across the name, The Apocalypse of the Pseudo-Methodius, many times here and there, never knew when it was written, by whom it was written, what it was about, nothing. Then as I was developing the podcast into the 7th century, I realized there's this seam of apocalyptic in the 7th century that kind of emerges out of the chaos of the Eastern Mediterranean, Jews, Christians. Even we're going to see in like the early Shi'i movement, there's a lot of like sort of future prophecy, sacred history stuff happening,
absolutely,
sacred kingship stuff happening. So can you tell us about those two things? First of all, the rapid expanse and translation of this work, its Nachleben, how it spreads everywhere, and how come no one's heard of it, in at least in Western Europe?
Yeah, no, those are all excellent questions. So why does it spread? Yes, it seems to spread extremely quickly. So just to give a little bit of a overview, we don't know when it's translated into Greek, but it must have been translated into Greek very quickly because, as I mentioned before, we have these Latin manuscripts from the Merovingian Frankish kingdom. And those are not translations of the Syriac, but translations of the Greek. So the Greek must have been translated around the year 700 so that we could have these 8th century Latin manuscripts. We also have versions in Armenian that may also go back to the 8th century. We have a fragment in Coptic that has been dated on paleographic grounds to the 8th century. Something seems to be going on in the 8th century especially. But then later on, we have the Old Church Slavonic translation. So it's the language of, or at least the liturgical language of medieval Christian Slavic polities. And then in the early modern period, it really explodes the Latin into the vernaculars of Western Europe. It's tested in pretty much every vernacular, including English, right? We actually have, I believe, three different Middle English versions.
Wow.
Part of the popularity of this text, well, first, often its popularity is attributed to its polemic about the sons of Ishmael, right? The Muslims or the Arabs. And there's something to that, right? It's definitely popular in periods of conflict with non-Christian peoples. But I think you can't really separate that from what it has to say about the endurance of Christian empire, right? Not just that, oh, they're these non-Christians and they're bad and they're going to do bad things to Christians, but that Christian empire will triumph and defeat them in the end, because the Christian empire is undefeatable, it is invincible, right? And going back to late antique eschatology, right? So I was talking about the various interpretations of the Book of Daniel. Our earliest commentary in the Book of Daniel is by Hippolytus of Rome, this third century Christian figure. And he takes a very negative view of the Roman Empire. It's this idea that when Christ was born, all of humanity was sort of split into two different opposed camps. You have, on the one hand, the Romans, who are this multinational army opposed to God, and the Christians, this multinational army in favor of God, and they are locked in conflict, and the Romans are the fourth kingdom, the evil oppressors of God's people. And actually, Hippolytus of Rome's commentary is extremely popular throughout Eastern Christendom. And other commentators build off of Hippolytus. In the Latin tradition, Jerome, again, is an important figure. He writes his own commentary on Daniel. And it's not so negative about Rome, right? You could be a Christian and a Roman at the same time. But the Roman Empire is still doomed to defeat and destruction. That he says that he's taken this idea from Hippolytus that towards the end of time, there's going to be this big civil war. The Roman Empire is going to be divided in the civil war. That's going to remove the Roman Empire's power to restrain the Antichrist. There's this idea going back to late antique Christianity that the Roman Empire is the force that keeps the Antichrist from arising. So that power is going to break in a civil war. And who's going to win that civil war? It's going to be the Antichrist. And he's going to be crowned emperor, and he's going to use the Roman Empire for another persecution, right? Like, Hippolytus was living in a period where the Romans were actively persecuting Christians. And Jerome is writing in a Christian empire, early 5th century, he's writing his commentary, but that memory is still alive, right? And the memory of Julian the Apostate is especially still alive. And so there's...
On the Schwepp, we just call Julian the Emperor, or Julian the Great.
Yes, Julian's memory is still alive here. And so there's this idea, right, that, oh, those persecutions you saw before, you ain't seen nothing, right? Like, the Antichrist is going to become Roman emperor, and he is going to do terrible things, and that is going to be the final persecution. That idea is widespread throughout late antique and medieval eschatology, that the Antichrist is going to be a Roman emperor, and that when Christ returns, he is going to destroy the Antichrist and the Roman Empire with him. And pick a side, right? You could be a Christian and a Roman, right? But that Christian identity has to be foremost, right? If you think Augustine and the City of God, right? We are foremost citizens of the City of God, not the earthly city, the City of Rome. What Sunna Methodius, I think, does, what makes Sunna Methodius very popular, is it's taking this idea that up to that point was a marginal idea that you only really found in late antique Syriac exegesis or eschatology, especially outside the Roman Empire, amongst these Syriac Christians who are idealizing the Roman Empire from afar. It's taking that idea that, no, the last Roman emperor is not the Antichrist. The last Roman emperor is going to be a great heroic ruler. Right? Mm. The last Roman emperor is a liberator and a savior of Christians. And the Roman Empire is not going to be violently destroyed at Christ's second coming. The Roman Empire has a sacred role in the end of time. In fact, its role is to initiate the events of the end time. And so you have this sort of redemption of the idea of empire, of Christian empire in Pseudo Methodius within Christian eschatology. And I think that's a major reason for its popularity. Another thing is that this last emperor figure can be interpreted in various ways, right? As various figures, and you could go a lot of really interesting directions with that, right? So in the Byzantine world, the Byzantines very quickly embraced the idea of this last emperor. Now, it's always, I don't want to exaggerate this. There's that Hippolytan pessimistic view of the fate of the empire is always there. In the Byzantine world, especially, I actually think that the Hippolytan view has more staying power than Pseudo Methodius. Pseudo Methodius sort of pops in and out of popularity. I'd say, especially in times when the empire is in a lot of trouble, and there's a desire to say, "Hey, wait a minute, maybe things aren't that bad. Actually, maybe we might win. Right? The Arabs seem to be beating us. Well, maybe, you know, maybe we're going to triumph over them because of these prophecies that we see, right? Maybe the Ottomans are kicking our butts. Well, what about this last emperor who's going to come and save us?" But there's still a lot of that pessimism there, right? And then initially it seems, I think part of the popularity of Pseudo Methodius in the 8th century is a desire throughout the Christian world to see the Eastern Roman Empire survive all the travails it's going through. And so the last emperor figure is almost always... when Pseudo-Methodius is translated in a way to make clear that this figure is a Byzantine emperor. So in the Greek, he's the Vasileus Romaeon, right? He's the emperor, the king or the emperor of the Romans. In the Latin, he's the Rex Romanorum. Yeah. What quickly happens, though, I know you had Anthony Caldelis on the podcast, and he talked very importantly about how the Byzantines always saw themselves as Romans, right? They are the Romans. Hence, you know, the Greek Pseudo-Methodius, again, the last emperor is not the king of the Greeks anymore. He's the emperor of the Romans. Over time, though, none of the Byzantine Empire's Christian neighbors buy that anymore. They become the Greeks to everyone except the Muslim neighbors, right? So that introduces this really interesting wild card factor that, well, now you have this idea that the last emperor is the king of the Romans. No one but the Byzantines think of the Byzantines as Romans. So who is this figure, right? So, in Armenian apocalyptic literature, the last emperor becomes a crusader, right? He's a king of the Romans. He's going to come out of the West and rescue us. In the Latin-speaking world, it becomes the Holy Roman Emperor, right? In fact, but at a certain point, I think in the 11th century, the Holy Roman Emperors start using the title Rex Romanorum, the same title used for the last emperor in Pseudo-Methodius. So it becomes very clear, oh, this must refer to a Holy Roman Emperor, to the point that, you know, Pseudo-Methodius becomes really important to the Habsburg dynasty into the early modern period, because they're the ones who hold that title.
And it even gets printed during the Siege of Vienna. Am I right about that?
So I actually have an article about this. That is apocryphal. I looked for that. I looked for the Pseudo-Methodius printed during the Siege of Vienna. It is printed in 1683 at the time of the siege, but in Switzerland. So it's not, so it's being printed when the Ottomans are besieging Vienna, but not in Vienna itself. But clearly Christians elsewhere, right, are seeing this happening and saying, what's going on? Can we use Pseudo-Methodius' prophecies to interpret that? And after the siege in 1691, this Viennese author, Jacob Wagner von Wagenfels, pretty cool name. He's tutor to Emperor Leopold's son, and he writes this tract about the glorious future of the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation. And in there, he quotes extensively from Pseudo-Methodius. And part of his point there is that the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation is the fourth kingdom of Daniel, and therefore must survive until the end of time as God's viceroys. Right. And he's quoting extensively from Pseudo-Methodius and says, look, the Siege of Vienna that just happened, I think that's what Methodius was talking about. And he was talking about this emperor, you know, Leopold, it's you. And there's a very long tradition of that in sort of Habsburg political literature, mirrors for princes. Charles V, one of the most important Habsburg rulers, right? His chancellor, Mercurino.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Charles V ends up kind of ruling all of Europe briefly, right?
Yeah, it's the largest European empire since Charlemagne. And not only is he ruling Europe, he's also claims America. The entire New World. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
He is a universal monarch of the sort that hasn't been seen since ancient Rome, right? At least in the Christian world, right? And so you have people like his chancellor, Mercurino di Gattinara, writes this text to him and says, your Methodius had this prophecy about this emperor who's going to go to Jerusalem, and that's you. It is your destiny to restore the Christian empire, and it is your destiny to defeat the enemies of Christendom. In this case, he's referring to the Ottoman Empire, right? It's your destiny to defeat the Ottomans, and you're going to be the one who goes to Jerusalem and surrenders your crown. And so this is very alive in the early modern Austrian, Spanish political ideology.
Crazy.
So, all right. So then you had the question of why have we not heard of this text?
Yeah.
Why has Pseudo-Methodius fallen into obscurity? There are a few reasons for this. I think one of the most important is what starts to happen is, especially in Western European scholarship, with the rise of scholarly criticism.
Yeah.
There is a growing sense that Methodius could not have written this text. This text knows about the Arab conquests. Methodius wrote in the 4th century. And if you're going to approach this text skeptical of the idea that people receive divine revelations, right? If you're coming at it from a more humanist viewpoint, well, then Methodius can invert in this text.
Yep.
And therefore, it's not a real prophecy. And as I said earlier, there's a long period where the leading theory becomes Methodius, the Patriarch of Constantinople, wrote the text. But then it's understood as sort of Byzantine propaganda of this period of Byzantine resurgence in the 9th century as they're fighting the Arabs. And again, we know that's not true either, but that's a theory in which you've historicized the text.
Yeah.
And you're no longer seeing it as a divine revelation.
Yeah. If you have no way of knowing about the Syriac tradition, that's a super plausible. If you're assuming it's coming out of a chancery of Greek, you know, writing some Greek scribes of some kind, 9th century Constantinople is a super plausible place for it to come from, if you don't know anything.
9th century Constantinople is super plausible. Plus, Methodius, Patriarch Methodius, was Sicilian. He knew Greek and Latin. Mm. So if you don't know the Syriac, you'd be like, oh, he wrote both the Greek and Latin version. Like, we have a Greek and Latin, so this guy knew both languages, so that fits. Also, a number of the manuscripts say that this was the revelation that Methodius received in prison before his martyrdom. Patriarch Methodius of Constantinople was imprisoned by the iconoclasts before he became patriarch.
It's too perfect.
So it actually is a good theory.
Yeah.
It's a wrong theory, but it was a pretty compelling theory.
Mm.
Right. So once you no longer believe that is a divine revelation, that is a major blow. Another issue, because their scholars are already questioning this in the 15th and 16th century. Pico di Mirandola questions whether Methodius actually wrote this text. He's very skeptical of it. John Fox, the English hagiographer of the Anglican Church, right? He is very interested in Pseudo-Methodius. He kind of thinks that it might be a real prophecy because he uses it very effectively to try to argue that the popes are the Antichrist.
Yeah.
But he already is saying, well, maybe Methodius didn't write it because it's not attested in any of our biographical sources on Methodius, right? So Jerome and then in Greek the Suda mentioned the works that Methodius wrote, and they don't mention a revelation. So maybe he didn't actually write this. Once you hit the Reformation and Counter-Reformation, once you have these really serious scholars going at it, Bellarmine, people like that, they do not believe that this is Methodius anymore.
Yeah.
But there's still some attachment, even like I said, with people like Fox, there's some attachment to it, even if you're skeptical, because like I said, Fox is doing his own Protestant thing, trying to call the popes the Antichrist with this text. But much more commonly, it's used to respond to the Ottomans, right? And fear of Ottoman conquest, to show that, no, the Christians will triumph with the Ottomans in the end.
Yeah.
And after the 17th century, once the Ottoman Empire is no longer perceived as a threat to Western Christendom, the Western Christian powers, a lot of the interest drops off in the West. There's still interest in the Orthodox world because they are now in a position much like the original Syriac author, where they're living in a Islamic empire, right? Mm-hmm. So there's an appeal that remains, but even in the Orthodox world, it starts to drop off as you just get new prophecies that are more relevant to the times, that are more explicitly anti-Catholic, which becomes an important theme, more pro-Russian, right? And I think another really important factor is the idea of universal Christian empire starts to fade as well in this time as national empires sort of start to replace that. That's why I think sort of some of the last gasps are the Austrian Habsburgs, who are still, against all odds, against all proof to the contrary, trying to maintain this facade of universal Christian empire. But there's still occasional bits of interest you see in Pseudo-Methodius. So one of the later instances of the publication is shortly after the foundation of the July Monarchy in France. There's this collection of prophecies that are put together in the 16th century in Latin about the sacred authority of the French kings, the Mirabilis Liber. And in the 19th century, in 1831, it's translated into French, I think, for French conservatives, right? In this period of the restoration of the monarchy. And Pseudo-Methodius is the first text in that collection.
Crazy.
So,
There are so many. So thank you for all of those concrete historical examples. We can see this text echoing down history. We can see that it's a very complex reception indeed. I really like that you brought up this sort of countercurrent, which is the earlier, let's say, pre-Justinianic current of how you consider the Roman Empire vis-a-vis the Book of Daniel, the book, the sacred history of the future, where the Roman Empire is bad, roughly speaking. Uh-huh.
Well, and I don't want to say that it's early. I mean, it is earlier. It originates earlier, but that never goes away. Like that is actually the kind of the default. I think Pseudo Methodius is not the default. It is an alternative. It's a weird outlier that you could occasionally bring up. It's like, oh yeah, Augustine is all about how we are citizens of the city of God, not the earthly city. That God doesn't really care about empires so much, right? That is sort of basic Christian understanding. Pseudo Methodius can be used to question that. I just don't want to overemphasize how common that is because yeah, there is a discomfort with, you know, Christianity has this complex relationship to the state, right?
Yeah.
Where you have the dual legacy of the Roman persecutions and Constantine, right? And I think throughout its history, Christianity is trying to sort that out.
Yes.
And Pseudo Methodius is part of that story.
Exactly. And even to reduce it to two different currents within Christian apocalyptic is already oversimplifying it. But if we just consider those two ideal types, you can see them snaking and intertwining with each other throughout your intellectual history. It's very different in Western Europe than it is in the Orthodox world. It's going to take. And then when Protestantism comes on the scene, all bets are off. But this incredible complexity is really interesting. The way that thinkers will each take bits of these complex apocalyptic traditions and try to figure out politics based on them. Which bits can you accept? Which bits can you not accept? Where do you actually try to figure out the dates based on the dating given and figure out when the world's going to end? Where do you just ignore the dates? Because that's, you know, like all of these questions are going to be really, really important going forward.
And incidentally, on what you said about Protestantism, you know, one of the things that we see happening in the West in the early modern period, it's might be of interest to you because of the esoteric angle.
Yes.
Is the fusion of pseudo-Methodian eschatology with Joachim of Fiore's, right? Joachim does not seem to have known. So Joachim is this high medieval apocalyptic author who writes extensively on the Book of Revelation and history, right? He does not seem to know Pseudo-Methodius, actually. But his followers do, and his followers start to reconcile Pseudo-Methodius with Joachim, right? Joachim has this idea of the third status, this third age that will dawn. And the problem is what has to happen to make the third status come into its full bloom, right? That gradually unfolding, but it has to happen. And one of the problems is that the church is the source of the corruption and lack of piety within Christianity is an impediment there, the corruption of the church, right? And then this tends to take on a lot of force running up to the Protestant Reformation that you're coming out of the period of the Avignon Papacy, the Great Western Schism, where you had three popes at the same time, all claiming to be the true pope, right? There's a lot of dissatisfaction. And then the question becomes, well, who's going to sort this out? And if we could sort this out, we can maybe get to that golden age that Joachim talked about, right? Well, who has historically been the major sort of protagonists or counterweight to the papacy was the Holy Roman Emperors, going back to the investiture controversy, to the conflicts between Frederick Barbarossa and Frederick II with the papacy. So Pseudo Methodius then fits in there. Well, actually, we're going to get another Holy Roman Emperor who is going to usher in the end of times, because what does Pseudo Methodius tell us? That it's going to be the Roman Emperor who initiates the eschaton. If the Roman Emperor is going to initiate the eschaton and the Roman Emperor is the great enemy of the papacy, well, it's pretty clear what's going to happen. This emperor is going to rise. Yes, he's going to defeat the Ishmaelites. He's going to defeat the Muslims. He's also going to go to Rome and you have different versions of it. Some of them, you have this Italian dissident monk religious leader Fra Dolcino, you know, he says this last emperor is going to go to Rome, he's going to massacre the cardinals, and he's going to raise up the pope that he wants, and
that's some reform.
You get more peaceful versions of that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
And incidentally, that's why Charles V seems to fit this all so well when he comes along, that he goes on crusade in Tunis. His troops sack Rome and imprison the pope. He's a Roman emperor who rules over, you know, an enormous territory. He inherits the title King of Jerusalem. So that's why things seem to really, really fit him.
Yeah.
And there may also be a little bit of a drop of interest once Charles V doesn't pan out, because he seemed like so perfect.
Yeah. Like, people at the time were thinking, oh my God, we're doing it. We're actually doing it. Like, the Roman Empire is back, and it even controls the new world.
Yeah.
Christendom has never been stronger, and we have one king, one, you know, one faith, etc. All we got to do is straighten these popes out, these corrupt institutions, and the end times are here, right?
Exactly.
Few times in the many times in this sweep of European history when it seemed clear that the end times were here, few have been as good candidates as that epoch. You know what I mean? When the Habsburgs controlled all of Europe for a brief moment. Crazy stuff.
He even defeats Francis I, the King of France. So there's this idea like maybe he's going to reunite the whole thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't pan out again, but like there are these moments where it's looking pretty good for Charles. Anyway, just on the Orthodox world, because I know you wanted to talk about that. In the Orthodox world, you have this, the idea of the last Roman emperor, the idea of the last emperor survives in Byzantine and post-Byzantine apocalyptic literature. And what ends up happening is that figure gets assimilated with Emperor Constantine XI, the final Byzantine emperor, right? So that you have this idea that he did not die in 1453 in the siege of Constantinople, that he was whisked away by an angel and turned to marble, and maybe in the Hagia Sophia or under the Golden Gate, somewhere like that, waiting to return. So it takes on that immense importance.
So from my own sort of anecdotal investigations, I did an episode about the Hagia Sophia and the idea of esoteric architecture. What better edifice to use as a case study? And a lot of listeners got in touch and said, hey, I'm Greek, and I grew up being told that there's an emperor who's a statue in Hagia Sophia, but one day he's going to come back to life and lead the Christian faithful to blah, blah, blah. A sort of Barbarossa stroke Charlemagne stroke King Arthur trope that we're all familiar with, Messiah in some Jewish flavors of Judaism. And I went to Greece not long ago and asked around, and people know this. This is a bit of Greek folklore that everyone knows. Not everyone believes, obviously, but everyone's heard of the Vasilevs Marmaromenos, I believe he's called. The marbleized...
Yes, the marble king.
King or emperor. So, yeah.
There's a play or opera, I believe it's Stamati Spanodakis, from the late 90s, called The Marble King. And it's about Constantine XI and the final song, San Astrape, like lightning. It's about his return, that he will return like lightning. You can find it on YouTube. It's great. It's in Greek, and it's about Constantine XI returning as the last emperor. Mm. And this is something from the 90s, and was seemed like, you know, kind of a well-known Greek musician and the performance that was put on. Like, again, you find various performances on YouTube. Like, this is very alive in the Greek national consciousness. I mean, again, I don't know how many people believe it as literally true, but it's part of this, you know, surviving memory of the Byzantine past.
Yeah. Well, also probably a memory that has been amplified, whether intentionally or just accidentally, by the project of Greek nation building in the 20th century, 19th, 20th century.
Absolutely.
Like, we have to create a Greekness. And, you know, some of that's Christianity, some of that's ancient Athens, some of it's this, some of it's that. It's not Turkish, you know, like all that whole process of cultural identity building
Yeah, and similar to what we're talking about with the Habsburgs and Charles, you had this moment with, you had a King Constantine who conquered northern Greece and looked like he might take Constantinople. And I think there's a little bit of disillusionment when, for various reasons, the First World War, you know, the defeat in Asia Minor, all that didn't really pan out. But, you know, it was another similar situation where it seemed like you had this prime candidate who even had the name.
Christopher Bonnura, you are the man. Thank you so much for coming on and introducing Pseudo-Methodius, but maybe even more importantly, some of its echoes in history. And for all that you've just covered, there's so much more that you've left out. So we'll be running into, in the course of the podcast, we'll be running into this apocalypse again. But people who want to get the So Much More can check out your forthcoming book.
Yes, A Prophecy of Empire, which will be out in November with University of California Press.
November 2025. Great.
And I've got the translation of the Syriac version at the end there, so that if you just want to read the text, a translation from the original Syriac with annotations to help understand the text better, that is a resource for people.
Fantastic. We're going to get into a little bit more of the Greek Pseudo-Methodius next time, with Benjamin Garstad, who did a translation of that text. But you've introduced us to the Ur text itself, its context, its present and future, as it were. So thanks very much for that. I appreciate it. Stay esoteric.
I will, Earl. I will.
Nice one.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure.